Welcome to Banyan Books, Branches of Wisdom, celebrating the joy of bright ideas and heartful lifelong learning. Branches of Wisdom is a series of intimate conversations with the world's most influential authors and visionaries. We explore spirituality and the human mind, ecology and culture. Most episodes are recorded with a live audience. You can join our live events and submit questions to your favorite guests. Check out our upcoming schedule at banyan.com. Since 1970, Banyan Books has been a rich oasis at the crossroads of wisdom and philosophy, offering resources for humanity's evolving paths. We're a locally owned, independent bookstore in the heart of Vancouver's Kitsilano neighborhood. Visit us in person or shop online at banyan.com. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews for the podcast. And now, enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Branches of Wisdom, the Banyan Books podcast. I'm your host, Ross McKeachy, and really, really excited for our guest today, Saad DeSimone. Before we get to his introduction, letting everybody know that although we have people joining us from all over the world for these live streaming events, the physical location of Banyan Books is on the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples, including the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Most of Banyan's podcast and event series are free. We welcome your donations to keep these programs accessible for all. Just go ahead and click on the PayPal link in the show description below. Also, towards the end of our conversation today, we'll be taking your questions for Saad. So please go ahead and type those into the comments field on YouTube, and we'll get to as many of those as we can. All right. Saad DeSimone is a spiritual revolutionary, artist, and the internationally best-selling author of Spiritually Sassy. He's known for hosting the top-rated Spiritually Sassy Show podcast and for creating the Somatic Activated Healing, or SA, method. SA works in the spiritual care department at Cedars Sinai Hospital and is a guest lecturer at Columbia University. His remarkable contributions to homeless youth in Venice Beach, California, earned him the CARE Award from the city and county of Los Angeles. He has shared the stage with Deepak Chopra, Young Pueblo, Ruby Warrington, and Dan Harris, and has collaborated with Google, MoMA, and the United Nations. Sa has been featured in notable magazines and resources, including USA Today, Refinery 29, Vice, and others. He has also been featured as a TEDx speaker. Sa is the author of 5-Minute Daily Meditations, and Spiritually Sassy, 8 Radical Steps to Activate Your Innate Superpowers. Today, Saad DeSimone is with Banyan Books in conversation about his new book, Spiritually We, The Art of Relating and Connecting from the Heart. In Spiritually We, Saad invites us to cast aside division to make room for fully engaged spirituality that heals through connection. Drawing from his own experiences of breaking boundaries and making connections, supported by contributions from scientists, communication experts, and other specialists, Sa shares a roadmap for becoming a healing presence in the world. If you'd like to learn more about today's honored guest, you can visit his website, saaddesimone.com, or follow him on Instagram at saaddesimone. Banyan community, a very big and warm welcome for Saad DeSimone.
Thank you so much, Ross. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. It's really, really a delight to have you.
Me too.
So I wanted to start by just sharing a quote and then that leading into a question. In chapter one, which is titled, We Need Each Other, you explain that this is not a book about how to make friends. You write that We're not in the realm of wellness or even just growth. No, we are on the high stakes path of spiritual liberation. And your freedom is only ever actualized in context with the other. That's the guiding principle of this book. Your freedom is only ever truly actualized in context with the other. Can you unpack that statement for us?
I love that you went to the heart of the matter right away, Ross. Thank you so much. So this is a little bit of an edgy, sensitive topic, because we do have to prioritize our well-being first. But I think there's a point where our self-care practices should catapult you into community care. And I think a lot of the psychosomatic spiritual space today is emphasizing too much on us feeling, you know, happy and healthy and excited and inspired, isolated, you know? And then there's a lot of language about how to create boundaries in a way that you can protect your peace. I think this is languaging that a lot of us have heard in the last few years. It's in the vernacular. It's like everyone is constantly saying, they trigger me, she sucks, she's toxic, he's a narcissist, cancel, delete, goodbye, gone, no contact. And all these things, to a degree, that's why I say it's fragile and sensitive, because to a degree, it is important for us to take time away from people, place, and experience that hurt us and perpetuate the cycle of pain that has been cooked into our lineages for a long time. So there is a need for personal development. There's a need for self-development, where you do it in a cushion, where you do it on your mat, where you do it in retreat, where you go to the monastery, where you go to the Himalayan cave, where you go to the quote, you know, quote here, holy places to arrive at a place of peace. But your peace, you only become peaceful, or the peace is a passing sensation, when you can test your material with other people. It's one thing to be peaceful at home in the cushion. It's another thing to be peaceful at the grocery store. It's one thing to be, it's a whole nother thing to be peaceful at the coffee shop. It's a whole nother thing to be peaceful at your in-laws holiday party. Can you bring the forgiveness, the kindness, the sweetness that you experience between you and you? Or are you discombobulated and entering into this overreaction or underreaction to life as soon as you close the door of your apartment and you step into the world? So this is what the foundation is. It's in the book, I say that if we're looking at the spiritual liberation path, which is different than being happy, it's different than feeling good. It's a state of openness. It's a capacity to be with grief and gratitude. It's a capacity to be joyful and mourning. And so that's why I say it's the high stakes path, because we're not seeking to feel well and feel happy. We're seeking to feel open to our full humanity that encompasses, you know, just like the day enters night, just like summer leads to winter, a fall and winter. I think a lot of us are navigating our lives with this view of good vibes only. We only want to feel one certain way. So we build our entire lives around, how quickly can I distract myself from the grief? How quickly can I distract myself and hover and leave the body, leave the present moment, away from the mourning, away from the rejection, away from the abandonment, away from the heartache? And I think that when we shy away from these very human experiences, we are missing a capacity of touching the fullness of our humanity, which is so beautiful. It's just we have these biases around certain feelings as being bad. So this openness of heart, this relaxation of mind, this deep somatic attunement helps us to experience it all with less duality, with less of a binary approach. So tying back to the equation, I believe, and there's scriptures to tie it back as well, but this is personal interpretation of how I have arrived at where I'm at right now. I'm not free by any means, but I know the way to it. I get glimpses of it. 50% of the work, Ross, has to be done between you and your body, you and your mind, you and your heart, and you and your whole history, your biography. And then the other 50%, it's between you and your friends, you and your community, you and every stranger you meet. I think too often we reserve our blessings to only those that we like, only those who follow the script that we wrote for them in our minds, you know? And if they go off the script that you wrote for them in your mind, then they're canceled, cut, delete, bye, see you never, toxic, narcissists, you know? Like the languaging that we have, say, as wonderful as it is, and you're going to constantly hear me bring paradox into every statement, because I think life is paradoxical. And if we can't handle two contradictory truths, we're not becoming free. Liberation isn't in one way only. Liberation is paradoxical. It urges us to hold all duality without the binary of view. So this is a little, this is the backbone of the book. You know, can I stop reserving my blessings to only those who are nice to me? Can I stop holding back the warmth of my presence to only those who are following the script that I wrote for them in my mind?
Yes. Yeah. It's a really beautiful book. Honestly, I want everybody to read this book, and I'm really grateful that you wrote this, because when we look around at the world today, there's so much polarization. There's so much of that lack of being able to hold paradox and duality and find the nuances in our conversations. So this is the right book at the right time. One of the things I'm really curious about, and you do touch on it in the book, I think for a lot of people, as they get onto their spiritual path, a lot of their friendships start to morph and change. You know, certain people, you're not sure how to relate to them anymore, or maybe you see the toxicity. Can you give some insight for us on how to navigate shifting friendships and how to find, as you call it in the book, our sacred friendships?
Mm-hmm. Great question. I think allow things to fall apart, as Pema Chodron so beautifully has gifted us this beautiful statement. Allow things to fall apart and know that as things, you know, die, as relationships end, it's hard to trust in the unseen forces that are working on our favor. It's really hard, right? Because so many of us have unfulfilled prayers, we have unmet needs. So it's hard to believe that there is unseen forces really supporting us in ways that we can't even imagine. However, I do want to emphasize that that we have to have a trust that as relationships end, new ones will be blossoming, new ones will come to meet you. And it's really important that we're not seeking these sacred friends at happy hour. Although it says this is the happy hour, 2-for-1 margaritas, this is where I'm going to find happy people. The truth is, this is the place where you're going to find people who are distracting themselves from the grief of their dead mother. These are the people who are hiding themselves, drinking themselves away after a heartbreak. They're not facing, they're not dancing with it. They're not learning from it. And so we really have to be where we wish to be found. So we have to prioritize going to the Banyan bookstore. We have to prioritize going to retreats. We have to prioritize going to, you know, the places that we want to meet the people that we want to experience life with. And it's so interesting that I think I saw that the Banyan is on Dunbar Street. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's so interesting to me, because a big thing that I share in the book too is the Dunbar research.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, what a nice synchronicity to weave this into the question, into our talk, but also to answer this question. At any given time, we have the capacity to cognitively know 150 people. So give and take face, names, personality, that. And within this 150, we go a layer deeper. We have a concentric circle within the 150 of 50 people. And from the 50, we have 15. And then from the 15, we have 5. So as we get closer and closer to that center circle, these are the most intimate relationships in our lives. So the idea that social media presents to us, that the more followers we have, the actual more friends we have, it is cognitively impossible, meaning the brain cannot hold the information for more people than 150. So it's kind of a relief, right? If you think about it, oh, wow, okay, cool. So the follower count does not mean that these are truthful friends that I have to, or that I will even get to know, or I will get to experience them. So the 150, if we're looking at the Dunbar research and languaging that Dunbar himself put forth for us, it says that those 150 are the people who will show up for you in that once-in-a-lifetime event, maybe your funeral or your wedding, like that. Then we're going a little deeper. The 50, these are the people who will come to the big birthday bash where you say, Ross, do you have a big backyard? Can I throw my 40th or my 60th birthday there? Ross is like, yeah, sure, no problem. So that 50, I'm just, you know, using you saying, okay, Ross is going to say yes to that big messy birthday. Yes. He says yes. So, and that big birthday is where you see people who are sort of in the outer skirts of your life, but some of them are people that you want to get to know, but you don't actually prioritize them. Now the 15 and the 5, this is where there is a sort of more of a dance where it's more conscious for you, where the 5 is usually like your family and your partners, depending what kind of structured relationship you're in. And the 15 and the 5, as I say, they dance together because people in the 15 may oftentimes, come into the 5, depending what's happening in your life, depending what's happening in their lives. But it's important to know that the 15 are the people who will show up for us when our mother dies. They will show up for us when we're going through a chemotherapy treatment. These are the people who could pick up your prescription at the local pharmacy because you can't get out of bed. These are the people who will fly across the world to attend your mother's funeral on a drop of a hat. These are the people who will come across the country or across the world to sit on a couch with you and give you a head massage and make you a chicken soup a couple weeks after your mother has died. These are the people who will initiate a prayer group for your mother's next journey without you having to even say a word, you know? So, and I know it's kind of hard to hear. It's like, I'm supposed to have 15, and then within that 15, I'm supposed to have this core 5. Yes, we do have the barometer this to aspire to. So when you ask, how do I deal with losing friends? I want to say that losing friends can open up on your spiritual journey, can open you up to see what's around. Maybe there are people in your 50 that you're not really letting in because of the best self mentality, which is something I speak about in the book. And it's a critical commentary. And I don't mean critical as necessarily bad and separatory, but I also do mean that. And again, paradox here, because the best self is if I am doing the Banyan Books events and I'm listening to Ross and Ross's new podcast, and I'm out there, I'm doing the thing, I'm going to the retreats, I'm dancing the somatic dance with Sam, reading his new book, I'm doing the thing. I'm sober curious now. And if my friends are not doing that, and if they're not changing their body, they're not developing their mind, then they shouldn't walk the path with me. I want to say something against that. Mm-hmm. I want to remind you that even in my own life, the people who showed up for me, the friend who dropped his life in Miami on an evening from going out to dinner with his husband to immediately driving from the restaurant out to the airport to be at my mother's funeral the next day, this friend isn't someone that you would initially see, oh, best self mentality. Look at them doing the thing, meditating, dancing, eating a plant-based diet, whatever. All the ways, plug in your best self curriculum that we all have. And we may not want to deepen our bond with people who are not in the best self. And again, another contradiction, another paradox here. We do have to surround ourselves with people who carry the same degree of integrity, meaning that they do aspire for a peaceful life, for a life that's service-oriented, to a life of compassion and kindness. And the way they do it does not have to be the way that you do it. So this is where the dance becomes fragile, and that's when friendships become a gardening experiment. You know, how much sunlight and fertilizer and water am I willing to give to certain friends to see where it could go? Don't hold yourself back from watering the seeds of service, of inspiration in your friend's garden because you believe that they won't change. You believe that they are stuck in who they are. And some people perhaps have been, but this is where we have to open ourselves up to be surprised, to allow ourselves novelty, to allow ourselves to see people changing. So we are also, when we notice change, we also notice our own change. So long answer to a short question, because it's not a prescription here. There is a little prescriptive approach to it, but what's really important is for us to know if are you losing weight and now you're looking at fat people and you're developing your fat phobia, are you meditating and now you are shaming people who don't meditate? Are you doing therapy and not engaging with people who don't do talk therapy? Like, we have to look if these healing modalities, are they connecting us? Are they bridging the gap from separation, from isolation to interdependence and interconnection? Or are they doing the thing that I have seen very closely, even in my own life, separation? Making, developing my superiority complex, putting me, myself on a pedestal where I was unattainable, where friendships couldn't reach, where people couldn't connect, and I couldn't feel their suffering. I couldn't feel their grief. So how could I offer support if I can't feel with you, you know, like that?
Yes. Yes. I know that for myself personally, that has been, you know, a challenge as I've developed on my spiritual path, is you deal with that spiritual ego, that spiritual arrogance, and using it as a way to push people away and escape all of the pain in your life. You're hoping it's going to be this escape hatch.
Yeah. It's just not. It's just not. It's literally right through it. And granted, you know, I did spend a few years, me and my sister would call each other the Dharma police. We'd be, you know, policing everyone and everything as like not dharmic, not dharmic, not spiritual. And then you realize like, oh, we lost the plot. All things are spiritual. All things can be dharmic. It's just a matter of perspective.
Can you tell us a bit about your sister? She's also a teacher of sorts and working, guiding and coaching people. And it seems like you two have a really beautiful relationship.
We do. And it's, thanks for bringing her into the mix, Ross, because the initial book was going to be called Spiritual Siblings. And it was going to be a book that I would co-write with my younger brother and my older sister. I'm the middle, the troubled one, naturally. I think I can fulfill the cliche of the troubled middle child. So my sister and I, our relationship really blossomed and deepened when 10 years ago, it's a couple of weeks ago, it will be 10 years to the date, I left to India. And then I came back without an apartment, without a job, like late spring of 2014, after having spent time in Dharamshala in the north of India in silence, having been in the presence of the Dalai Lama, and then going to an ashram and chanting to the goddess and the gods and like losing myself through sacred music. And also by merging with the silence and really facing my own mortality through the power of meditation. I came back to New York and she, you know, housed me for a while. And it was so triggering for her to see how much I had changed in such little time. I was no longer this, you know, hyper agitated person. Not that I'm not like as expressive and as loud and bold. No, it's just the quality of it changed. The texture of it changed. It wasn't a constant need to crack a joke so I could distract myself. It wasn't a constant need to talk myself into connecting with people or feeling at home in my body. I think a lot of my, you know, over chatter was a way for me to distract myself from being in the present moment. And slowly, slowly, she started to be curious about it. And she was married at that point. And later that year, I went into fall of 2014, I went into a 30-day retreat in Kathmandu, Nepal. That's where I met my root guru. That's where I took refuge. That's where I had the, you know, this was the crucible of my liberation. It was like, oh, wow, I feel the change, but I also feel the enormous disorienting heartbreak of having lived in the ways that I have lived. And when I left for that 30 day, I didn't know that she was going to be leaving, breaking off her marriage and leaving to India to do a 10 day silent retreat. Week 3 of my retreat, I have a nearly psychotic break and I reach out to the reception, to the monks and nuns, and I say, I need to talk to my family. I believe that they're all dead. This was the level of paranoia. This was the level of my mind, where my mind had gone. I had fully believed with every ounce of my being that my entire family had died. And now I'm in a foreign country in silence on the other side of the world. So I'm breaking the silence, reaching out to the monks. And then I call my dad, and my dad was like, everyone is fine. And guess what? Moon is in India. Your sister is in India. Finish your retreat and go meet her. I was like, part of me was like, the selfishness came back, because my goal, my plan at that point was to finish the retreat and go hike Everest base camp. I had gotten the waterproof boots. I had got the Patagonia bag. I got the full gear, and I was like ready to go do Everest base camp. But my dad was like, you have to be there the day she leaves her retreat. And I said, actually, how amazing that I'm here with my sister, that she is also on the path to liberation. I come to meet her in Bodh Gaya. I spent the last 2 days of her retreat with her. And we had a moment under the Bodhi tree, under the tree of enlightenment, which is, you know, the story goes, the scripture, the myth is that at that place where you can go visit today, in Bihar, the state of Bihar, in the village of Bodh Gaya, is the place where the Buddha reached enlightenment, where he cracked the code. And he faced so many demons there. Mara came to visit, yada, yada. It's a whole odyssey that takes place under the tree. But I remember looking at my sister and just feeling so much utter gratitude and feeling this like, this is not the first time we're doing this. This is not the first time we are sitting under this tree. This is not the first time we are. Oh, and I feel a little emotional just thinking of it too. It's not the first time we sat here and we practice in this way for the benefit of all beings. That sort of bodhisattva initiation, that vow to freedom for the sake of all people. And then the rest is history. We've went back to India multiple times, and we've deepened and our practice and our studies and our capacity to lose ourselves into silence and to mantra. And yeah, and she lives in New York City, which is a bummer because I wish she lived here in Sunshine, California, Los Angeles, where I do. But yeah, we talk every day. You know, she's my Dharma sister, my older sister, but also it's beyond the biological blood sharing. It's a dharmic bond where when I lose the plot and when I miss a blind spot, she's the one that helps me course correct. She's the one who's like, honey, this way, not that way, you know?
Oh man, that's beautiful. What a sweet, sweet thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you, you talk about early in the book, the loneliness epidemic in our culture, in our aversion to the idea of needing others. I'm going to quote you. You write, "You're supposed to know how to self-soothe. You should be able to take care of yourself. You should be okay on your own. Asking for help or using the four-letter word need is an admission of failure." Can we talk about that?
This is so huge, Ross, because if we look at the statistics today, they're so alarming. And obviously I'm only sharing statistics, the statistic I know based in American culture, based in the United States. So there's research that shows that 60% of young adults in America feel seriously lonely. 60%, you heard that right. And the research shows that 2 out of every 5 people report that their relationships are not meaningful. which means they don't have people who have, you know, 2 out of every 5 people report that their relationships are not meaningful. What does that mean practically? That they don't have someone who can help them unburden their hearts, that they don't have someone who can help hold their deepest, darkest secrets. They don't have people who can support them through the inevitability of heartache in human life. And then the research continues to be scary and scarier. The statistics continue, shows that in the last few years, suicide rates have increased by 30%. And then this last statistic that I mentioned is not something I put in the book, because the book was already turned in when I decided to enter the medical field as a chaplain and be a chaplain in training at Cedars-Sinai, a big hospital here in Los Angeles. And what I noticed from offering bedside spiritual and emotional support to people in a variety of different circumstances, from complex oncology journeys to a simple surgery to someone who's actively dying, the full rainbow of humanity. And what I realize is that so many people are going through these experiences of hospitalization, which are really traumatic, alone, by themselves. They would have flowers in the room, a bag of cookies in their room. They would be on their phone, but not a human body would be there to help co-regulate them, to help hold some of the burden of being in this terrifying situation, totally loss of control, right? And then I started to inquire a little bit more. And what I found out is that based on research is that 40% of the elderly population says that it's really hard to have social support. And then being in the hospital, talking to social workers, case managers, being there myself, I realized that statistic is too conservative. That isn't the truth of the American medical system and the medical journey that people will go into. And what I found out is that we're looking more like 60 to 70% of the elderly population who navigates a hospitalization are alone, no social support, meaning they're not in contact with their families, they're not in contact with their friends. The only people who are in support of them is the nursing staff or caretakers that they pay. That is so heartbreaking.
I think 60 to 70%.
This is my understanding. And from talking to social workers and the medical staff at Cedars-Sinai, we're looking at 60 to 70% of the elderly population go through an oncology journey, go through a hip surgery, go through a Alzheimer's disease outburst alone. Literally, I have done shifts in the emergency room at nighttime. And the worst thing that tugs at my heart is not the trauma that I see happening. It's not the bodies arriving at the hospital, discombobulated or torn apart, or the people who've lost themselves to a psychotic break. No, what fills me with rage and deep sadness is people doing this by themselves. And the first question I ask is, where's your support system? Oh, you know, she lives a couple hours away. I didn't tell anyone. I think everything's going to be okay. This is the hyper self-reliant capitalistic hallucination that we all bought into, that we can do this human gig alone. But the book is a plea to a remembrance that we don't exist independently, individually from our own sides. We don't exist independently of the tapestry of humanity. We only exist in relationship to others. This is the truth of our experience. Now, it's so easy to believe that the more you produce, the more you do, the more you will feel connected, the more you will feel at peace, because the capitalistic agenda perpetuates the narrative that the more you accumulate, the better you feel, and the better you feel, the more people will want to be around you. And we have to really unsocialize ourselves from this subscription that's deeply hurtful and keeping us isolated and stuck. But it's hard, right? It's really hard because so many of us have to work multiple jobs to just keep the lights on. You know, there's a lot of statistics that shows that, you know, 40 to 50% of Americans have to skip a meal every day to be able to keep the lights on in their house. So it's hard to say, can you prioritize connection when they can't even keep food on the table? I understand that. I understand. And there are opportunities of to disconnect from the TV, to disconnect from their phone, to put the bottle away, to disconnect from the overeating, from the overdoing, to reach out and say, I need a friend. I need a friend, and not feeling disgusted and disturbed by the word need, because the human gig is impossible to do it alone. Did I answer your question? I don't even know.
Absolutely, you did. Okay. I mean, it's such a large topic. I mean, I love that you're giving these detailed, nuanced answers, because there's no simple solution or simple answer to it. And the conditioning and the structure of our society runs so deep that, you know, we're so focused on independence. And you mentioned the fear of becoming codependent, but I think, and then we miss the opportunity for interdependence, don't we?
Yeah. And this is a very nuanced experience, Ross. We have to know when we have allowed our need for connection to become the only point of inspiration in our lives, or the only point of I can get out of bed, I can eat, I can do the basic human things. We have to really understand the gray area of when have I lost the plot to being self-reliant, to being toxic self-reliant? When have I allowed my individualism to then catapult me from one extreme to the other one, from toxic individuality to codependency? And this is a fragile topic, because a lot of us believe that the word need, and I need a friend, I need connection, immediately lands a hand to being, you're so needy. Oh my God, you're so codependent. I don't like you. And goodbye. And you can't do things by yourself. You always need somebody there to support you. So you got to navigate, and you have to really have a self-editing practice to be able to understand, where are you at on the spectrum? Can I come closer to the middle way, not too self-reliant and not too codependent? Can I arrive at this point where I'm doing the self-revelation work by myself, but I'm also deepening revelation and actualization in relationships? So it's a fine, beautiful dance there. And also, we need to understand that a lot of people are not trained or even educated in this biological need, which I found so alarming and so beautiful when I was doing the research for the book and talking to different scientists, is that loneliness, the need for connection, strikes the body in the same way as hunger does. It's a cue for a nutrient that we are missing. Why are we not told this? Why are we not told that the same way that when we feel lonely, we should reach out, we should engage, we should put the phone down, we should watch the leaves dance in the wind, we should feel the sun kissing our skin together? Like, how did we miss the poetry of life, and we have just allowed reality to exist in the palm of our hands, in the phone or in the screen? How have we missed the novelty and the beauty and the fragrance of this reality that you and I are walking shoulder to shoulder? You know, so understanding that when loneliness strikes, it's a cue like hunger for a nutritional deficiency. You need it biologically, psychologically, and spiritually. This is no woo-woo, lost the plot, rainbows and sunshine, good vibes only rhetoric. It's not. It's a truth that scientists have empirical data, and the mystics have esoteric data to prove that we cannot do the thing alone. And we're not doing it. When we feel lonely in the couch, what do? We go to social media. And if you watch someone in line at the coffee shop in front of you, their habits are the same as yours. They go from Instagram to TikTok to their email to their text message and to the other thing and the other thing, and da, 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 and then just close all of it. And they pause in the present moment and they look around. They look around. The moment that a feeling surfaces in the body and they're asked to be with this comfort, they're asked to face the loneliness, what do? Socialize, deeply ingrained, deeply indoctrinated to distract. We pull up the phone, we go Instagram notifications, TikTok, email, the text message, the WhatsApp, and we close all of it up. And then we rest again for a couple moments. And then the feeling will surface again. the feeling will surface again and again until at some point you do something about it. And now a really also alarming thing we have to understand is that social pain like rejection, abandonment, shame, loneliness, strikes in the body, or I should say is interpreted by the human brain as physical pain. You heard that correctly. I'm not a scientist, but I'm so grateful that I've had such amazing people to connect with in the book, is that social pain is interpreted by the human brain like physical pain. So instead of us doing the thing that we do, which is to self-soothe by over-medication and by overdoing anything we can to cope with the pain in our body, we need to realize that when a social pain strikes, it's not for you to isolate and think you could do this alone. It's to actually engage, it's to actually reach out, it's to actually say the word, I need, and see what happens. See what happens. I was doing a podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the host asked me, how do we compliment a person, a stranger at a coffee shop? And I thought that was a prank question. I thought this was like a sneaky, funny question. And I was like, but what do you mean? And the host said, I genuinely mean that. How do we say, I like your shoes, or I like your outfit, or you look really nice today, or wow, you smell great, or what's your name? Do you live around here? Without sounding creepy, without even having the courage to name that. Social media and technology which were initially built to weave us together, have now deeply separated us and severed our capacity to name something beautiful that we genuinely inspire to a stranger. We don't know how to go to Banyan Books and sit on the floor next to a stranger while we're drinking a chai latte and say, what are you reading? Have you heard this quote? We don't know how to do that. We've lost the plot. So the book is a call back to it. It's like, we cannot do the human thing alone. And connection is the cure. Connection is the path. You know, and remember the story, right? That Buddha had a very developed disciple who apparently is his cousin, but a very, very developed disciple. Someone who had achieved multiple bhumis, multiple somatic states, multiple liberatory states, really embodied it. He asked the Buddha, hey, how important is friendship on the spiritual path? Is it maybe like one third or maybe like two thirds of the path? The Buddha pauses for a moment, and he was deeply immersed in silence, deeply practicing, dissolving, deeply practicing, weaving with the tapestry, blinks his eyes open and says, Ananda, my dear, friendship is the path. So if we have faith that these lineages, that these prophets and mystics who've walked earth have propagated a lineage that's based on evidence that they have cultivated liberation, if we have that faith, right? And it's not blind faith, it's being in the presence of an enlightened being and knowing that the atmosphere is warmer, that the atmosphere relaxes our discursive thinking, that the atmosphere brings us back into a body and unknots our nervous system. We have been around those people, or maybe it's a friend who carries themselves with that depth of presence. We have to practice understanding that there is I lost my train of thought here because I went, my mind was like, oh my God, the time I met the Dalai Lama in India, that was a feeling of just like, oh my God, I thought I was drugged. I thought I was high, because I remember after my 10-day silent retreat, the very first one ever, 10 years ago, I remember looking around and being like, oh my God, where is my discursive thinking? Where is the narrator? Where is the evaluator? Where is the inner critic? Where did it go? Why am I not feeling a tension in my belly and a tugging at my heart? What happened? It was the presence of this liberated being, you know, that really, you know, brought me into presence.
Right.
So I was making a point there, but I forgot.
About being in the presence of these beings. We can trust that they may know something. We're having a deep faith that their guidance is rooted in some form of knowledge, like a science that can lead us towards the understanding that friendship is so important on the path.
Yeah, A community is a group. Now I remember. Thank you for naming that, Ross. Thank you for tracking. So what I was leading back to, the point that I was making, is that if we believe that this Buddha creature, this Buddha being, was here 25 to 2600 years ago, if those scriptures, those, that commentary, that literature can support us to lead us to the other shore from suffering to nirvana, then that story about friendship being the path, then we have to have faith that it's in community that we are going to enter the next stage of our liberation and be able to sustain that. I think a lot of us have these glimmers when we're protecting our peace, when we are by ourselves, isolated, and we reach these beautiful experiences, and it doesn't lend itself to being us, to becoming us, because we're not testing our material. We're not engaging with the world. We're saying no to mom because she's a narcissist, and we're saying no to dad because he's an alcoholic. We're using these one word labels to dictate someone's humanity that is full of contradictions and paradox, just like ours, you know?
Yes. So we have some nice audience questions coming in here. Is it okay if we get to some of those?
Please, please.
Great.
Thank you, darling. Yeah.
Okay. There's one here from Lara. Lara says, how do I respond to people who have read the books and know the lingo and want to connect, but it's clear to me it's a show and not authentic?
I think this is really lends itself to the last point I was making here, which is we know the quality of presence. You know, I think the greatest drug, I'm using edgy language to really like elicit a feeling in you. I think the greatest drug is presence. I think we do everything we can to catapult ourselves into the present moment, into feeling like we are in this body, is that we're not derealization or depersonalization or disassociation through life. You know, that we're really here, really here. And if presence is the greatest gateway drug, if presence is the greatest high that we can achieve as human beings, testing, experiencing, what is it like to be with these people? Am I co-regulated into presence? Am I brought into my body by being around these people? I've had someone ask me the other day at the hospital. I was talking to another chaplain at the cafeteria at the hospital, and the chaplain asked me, she's like, Saad, do you open your eyes to see if a patient is praying with you or if they're meditating with you? And I had to like look at my day, and I was like, actually, no, I don't open my eyes to see if they're practicing with me, because I know from personal experience that if I can rest in the silence, if I can bring all the little parts of me to the experience of the breath in my body, if I can be in that space of inhabiting the present moment, it's a natural thing that happens. People will naturally entrain into that. We have this mirroring experience that happens in our brains, in our nervous systems, in our bodies. And obviously our spirit is craving us to be in the body. So I think I answered the question by offering a little bit more context to, if they're reading the books and doing the talk and they know the psychosomatic spiritual language, but their presence is not orienting us back into the body, back into the breath, in congruency and contact with the present moment, then we can use that as the barometer that freedom looks different outside, right? But it's felt similarly inside.
Right. And so are you saying, I just want to clarify, hopefully on Lara's behalf, because the first part of her question was, how do I respond to these people? Are you saying the response is just to hold that presence oneself and to be that presence?
Mm-hmm. How do I respond to those people? I mean, look, here's the question. There's a chapter in the book called Conflict is for Lovers. And in that chapter, it's such a contradiction, right? Conflict is for lovers. I would think that my lover wouldn't be someone that I would not be in conflict with, but it's the opposite. People who are your lovers that you love deeply, conflict is part of it because we're bringing each other into the innermost secret parts of ourselves. Now, I say this to build some framework to answer the question more deeply. Are these the people who are in your 5 or perhaps in your 15? Because we don't need to be naming conflict or calling people in to a conflict who are not holding these important roles in our lives. However, I say this with grace and comma paradox here, we can develop our capacity to call people in, not call people out, but call people in to addressing the strategies that they go about meeting their needs that perhaps is bumping up against your strategy of meeting your needs. So therefore, we can carry ourselves in an illuminatory way, I'm making up a word now, in a way that brings awareness to people's blind spots. But ideally, we start naming conflict and naming that, hey, sounds like there's a little bit of lack of integrity here. You've done it. You've read the books. You listen to the podcast. You are a regular Banyan Books. But I am noticing. And when I notice this, I feel this. And when I feel this, this is the story I have about me in your mind, about that story I've built in my mind about you. And this is what leads me. This is what the felt sense, the feeling tone, the stories in my mind leads me to want to do, is to cut you out, to not walk life alongside you. You know, so we have to see, like, are we willing to bring forth conflict and naming the unnameable, bringing the obscure into the light, into the table, so we can dissect it and be with it and explain how we both see the experience, because all of us have a different perspective, you know? And therefore, you can deepen your connection. So you have to see, like, are these the people who are in the 5 or the 15? Because if they're not, and if you're not someone who is habitually calling people in, if you're not the one who is habitually living with deep integrity, then it might be easier to start calling in integrity and calling into conflict with the 5 or the 15 before you kind of enter the world as someone who is advocating and naming the unnameable. Does that make sense? Did I answer it now?
Yes. Yeah, I think you did. I think so. It was both parts of the answer were equally valuable, but I really like that because I know for myself, I shy away from wanting to name things that people in my circle are doing. I, you know, the spiritual attitude of, you know, that's their lesson to learn. I don't want to interfere. But I also know on the other side, I really appreciate it when a trusted friend in a kind way points something out to me.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful. Can I say something about that?
Yeah.
I think there is that fine line of this is their karma, but it's also your karma, right? If you are in relationship, it's part of your experience. And I think there's a fine line of people like, you know, sending blessings and prayers silently, and there's another need for advocacy. So it's that fine line of like how much of the work is silent between you and how much of the work is outspoken between you and them. And I have people in my life where I have on my to-do list right now, two people that I have to name something that I feel hurt by. You know, it's on my to-do list to do within the next 2 weeks. One of the people who was on the list that I needed to name some a hurt, because these are the people that are in my 15. These are the people that I want to walk the longevity of my life for as long as I may live together. These are the people that I want to do the deep work with. One of the people, I sent a message saying that I wasn't feeling well, you know, yada, 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 all this stuff. And then it took this person like 2 days to get back to me, but she did. And how she responded and called and reached out was so beautiful. And guess what I did in response? I didn't respond to the text. I didn't respond to the call to show some punitive approach to how we relate to each other. This punishing unconscious behavior that we have towards each other. And then I checked myself and I was like, oh, look at me doing the thing that I preach to never do. Integrity, come on, get back into your body, get back into your practice. And then I called a friend and I was like, I was feeling, these are the stories that I was holding in my mind about you and the experience. And she was like, oh my God, let me tell what I was going through. Let me tell what I was holding. And then oftentimes we realize how ridiculous it is and how not in alignment our thinking is and our feeling is, because, you know, it's really hard to arrive at a point where our felt sense matches the context of reality. We're either overreacting or underreacting. We're not in sync, in congruency, in interdependence with reality. When happy things happen, we're not happy. When sad things happen, we're not sad. You know, so there's this over or underreactionary approach to life, which again separates us.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I think we've got time for one more a question. This is actually from Jacob, our awesome producer who's working in the background, who makes all these events happen. He asked, what do you think about the idea that it is not our partner or friend's responsibility to heal our inner wounds versus the idea that we are wounded in relationship and we heal in relationship? It's another one of these paradoxes.
I am going with the latter. This is what I have noticed. It's like, if you look at our self-destructive behaviors, we don't start them by ourselves. You know, the coping mechanisms, the little self-hatred, little things that we do, or maybe if you're active in your addiction, the big ways that we harm ourselves, we don't start that by ourselves. You know, if you look at the way you feel and think, it's all relational. It's literally all a relationship. So I'm a firm believer that we are wounded in relationship and we have to heal in community. So I'm a firm believer that this is the path. And if you have had a moment of unburdening a deep, dark secret to a trusted friend, and they can receive that from that place of presence, from that place of relaxation, from that place of non-duality, where Rumi says, you are in that field, the Sufi poet, you are in that field beyond right or wrongdoing. And what I call in the book is the plane of secrets. When a friend can meet you there in the plane of secrets, where they can hold the deepest, dark, wounded aspects of yourself, perhaps the ways you've harmed other people, perhaps the ways you've harmed yourself, what it's like to unburden that to someone, it's someone who can hold you in that non-dual space beyond right or wrong, beyond good or bad. It's so transformative. We experience a transfiguration of our transgression. And that is the power of relating, of healing in relationship. We can work towards that. That takes a lot of work. And also, I want to name, a lot of people have been married for 10, 15, 30 years, and there's things that their partner doesn't even know, or their therapist doesn't even know because they're afraid. I always do my best effort to let my therapist know the level of chaos that my mind offers me regularly, the level of insanity that I'm faced with on the regular. And is it me, that insanity? No, it's part of the societal hallucination of where we're at right now. So I always like to bring forth and have her witness me in it, so we can untie the knots of overly identification. We can untie the knots of personification, of becoming those stories, and we can witness with spaciousness, you know?
Yes. I'm really grateful, Sa, for your honesty, because I imagine that being in the spotlight as you are as a teacher and still really, you know, doing your work, you know, it can be a challenge to hold both of those roles. And I really admire the way that you hold both of those roles as student, practitioner, and as teacher. I just wanted to let you know that.
Thank you. I don't know how not to, you know. it's you know, I think the vow of sobriety and the vow to not lie, I tried to really live by that. When I did take refuge in 2014, I shied away from the vow of sobriety. I was like, no, I still need my drugs and alcohol, honey. Don't come for that. I'm going to meditate. I'm going to be a nice person. I'm going to think about the well-being of other people. But the drugs and alcohol, not yet. I need my pot. I need my whiskey. I need my ecstasy. I need my cocaine. It wasn't for another 3 years that I fully snapped out of it. So I know lucidity, and I want to live in that way. And also there's something beautiful too, to just allow your humanity. It's like, it's okay for me to make mistakes as a teacher. I never put myself in the guru position. People have tried to put me in that position. I'm always like, no, I'm not even your Buddhist teacher. I can be your teacher, but not your Buddhist teacher. I don't even give myself that power over anybody. I want to just be a friend on the path who's reminding of the way that you truly already know. But hey, we need a reminder sometime.
That's really refreshing and beautiful to hear. Thank you so much. We're just coming to our time. I want to remind everyone, we've been speaking with the really wonderful Sa De Simone about his new book, Spiritually We, The Art of Relating and Connecting from the Heart. Please get this book. It's full of wonderful information, integrating, you know, modern research and the traditions of the East. And of course, it's got a lot of wonderful practices in it too, that are really useful. Just a wonderful book. And Sai, I'm so grateful that you joined us today. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I'm wondering, do you have any closing thoughts, anything you want to let people know about that's coming up for you?
I would love for people to buy the book and read it with a friend. You know, I think we have to end the loneliness epidemic together. If we're looking at these statistics and letting them alert us to what we're missing and what other people are missing, let's be that for each other. Let's reach out, let's connect, let's use the word need and friendship and community more regularly. Let's remember that community is the cure. And the book can be a guide to help you do the thing that's so necessary for us.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for Branches of Wisdom, a podcast of Banyan Books and Sound, Canada's spiritual and healing resource since 1970. Our podcast producer is Jacob Steele. The show is edited by Abdo Habani. Watch all our conversations on YouTube by searching for Banyan Books, or listen on your favorite podcast platform. Please subscribe, follow, like, and leave your reviews and comments. We love to hear from you. For all our live events, books, and more, visit us at banyan.com.